From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Here and Now. Northern California's deadly car fire is slowing down after days of uncontrolled growth. At least six people have died, hundreds of homes destroyed, and officials continue to look for residents who are still missing. Ed Bledsoe lost his wife and the two great-grandchildren they were raising. He describes his final phone call with them to a CNN reporter.
He said, come and get me. The fire's coming in the back door. Come on, Grandpa. I said, I'm right down the road. He said, come and get us. Emily said, I love you, Grandpa. Grandma says, I love you, Grandpa. And then Junior says, I love you. Come and get us. Come and get us. I said, I'm on my way. My wife was the greatest woman in the world, and my grandkids was excellent.
Well, thousands are also fleeing their homes about 120 miles north of San Francisco, where two fires combined in Mendocino and Lake counties. And a third fire near Yosemite National Park killed a firefighter over the weekend. Jonathan Cox is Northern California Region Battalion Chief with Cal Fire, and he joins us from Redding. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks for having me.
I mean, it's been a tough week there, to say the least. Give us the latest of what you know.
Yeah, it's been a tough couple weeks for all of us in the fire service and obviously many parts of Northern California. Right now, overall, we have 17 major fires burning across the state, and that is burning over 200,000 acres. So for a point of reference, a football field is about an acre. This is just stretching our resources fairly thin, with over 12,000 firefighters from across the state and now from incoming states around us, either on scene or en route to these fires.
Yeah. Well, I'm seeing here that the fire's, 20% contained now, but that the firefighting conditions are extremely difficult.
Yeah, so the car fire specifically is a tale of two fires at this point. On the one side in Redding, we have good line within the city where it impacted structures and our priorities to get people home. But on the other side, we still have a pretty tough firefight in some pretty remote, rugged terrain where it is continuing to kind of burn in and out of canyons. So that is all complicated by the fact that we still have triple-digit temperatures right now and a really thick smoke inversion, which slows down our ability to get aircraft in the air because of visibility.
Wow. Now, are there likely to be any more evacuations of residents?
So as far as the car fire is concerned, we're definitely not out of the woods on the Trinity County side, and there is a potential for more evacuations on that side as the fire progresses kind of in a northwest direction. We always recommend people in those areas are ready to go, and if they do feel unsafe, to leave at their own accord.
I mean, we have had fatalities already. I mean, how dangerous, how fast are these fires? How ready do people have to be?
Yeah, we are seeing an unprecedented beginning to what is traditionally a fire season in California and what we now kind of refer to as the new normal year-round. People across the state right now should be on alert that if there's a fire that is burning in the area, although it may look small and fairly benign at one point, can quickly change. And Redding was an unfortunate and tragic example of just kind of how fast conditions can change on these fires. And, we mourn the loss of all these community members and our own fellow firefighters. It's a really tough situation for all of us, and we're all working 24 hours a day just to kind of bring it to an end.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, speaking of firefighters who lost their lives, there's that fire outside of Yosemite, which we mentioned, and a firefighter died there just yesterday. Can you tell us about that?
I did hear that it was an accident on the fire line. I can tell you as a firefighter, my reaction, is that sinking feeling in your stomach and that first thought, like just when I thought it couldn't get any worse, and I think that's the general sentiment with firefighters everywhere is how bad is this going to get?
Yeah. Now, you mentioned that this is an unprecedented beginning to what you're calling the new normal regarding fire season in California, which usually extends through September. So you've got a couple of months still ahead of you. Do you think that conditions will change? Is it just going to stay, bad through the rest of the summer?
We're in the first couple innings right now of the fire season in California, and that year-round kind of environment we have right now is just kind of leading to these conditions that are continuously dangerous. I think at the moment we're a little bit at the mercy of Mother Nature. The winds and the temperatures are really what we battle against, those forces of nature at the moment. So, it's going to take a lot of hard work, a lot of sweat, and a little bit of luck from Mother Nature as well for things to continue to improve.
Yeah. Jonathan Cox, if I may ask you, this is starting to happen year in and year out in California. Do firefighters have the support that they need, from the state? You mentioned other firefighters coming in to assist what's happening in California, but, if we can predict something bad like this every year, is the system sort of built in now to cope.
Yeah, so I think there's several things going on there. That is definitely recognized from a state level, and definitely recognized that not only do we have to kind of bolster our response capabilities, which we are doing year in and year out every year, adding capacity, but also focusing on the prevention and the mitigation side before these fires actually happen as well. So that two-pronged approach is very front of mind for everybody across the state right now, and moving forward with addressing this new normal is front of mind for all of the fire managers across the state.
And prevention, though, meaning what?
Prevention meaning everything from how we manage our lands, how we manage our forests, where we build, how we build, the clearance around structures, and ways to actually prevent fires from starting, whether it be on a roadside or in a community. So there's many factors that go into that, and that is a big piece of the puzzle as well to address so that we can reduce the number of them as well as respond to them.
Yeah. Well, Jonathan Cox is Northern California Region Battalion Chief with CAL FIRE. Thank you so much, and please do stay safe.
Thank you.
Well, voters in Pennsylvania will elect a governor in November, and the two major party candidates have clear and contrasting views on the issue of abortion. Dave Davies from member station WHYY explains why the issue will likely play a larger role than usual in the upcoming election.
Abortion rights has long been an issue in Pennsylvania politics, and it's likely to assume even greater prominence this fall for one reason.
It is my honor and privilege to announce that I will nominate Judge Brett Kavanaugh to the United States Supreme Court.
The prospect of Judge Kavanaugh replacing the soon-to-be-retired Justice Anthony Kennedy on the Supreme Court raises the possibility that the court could overturn the landmark Roe v. Wade decision legalizing abortion and leave it up to states to set their own rules. In a state like Pennsylvania, where the legislature has been willing to approve abortion restrictions, a gubernatorial veto could be the last line of defense for pro-abortion rights advocates. Sari Stevens, executive director of Pennsylvania Votes, the advocacy arm of Planned Parenthood, says that's just how she sees incumbent Democratic Governor Tom Wolf.
The governor is currently a brick wall. He's our backstop. But that could potentially get even more dramatic if the Supreme Court returns the right to legal abortion to the states, which is absolutely possible.
Stevens says Wolf's commitment to reproductive rights for women is longstanding. Before he entered politics, he and his wife were volunteer escorts for patients visiting Planned Parenthood health centers in York County. Wolf says he knows where he stands.
Whatever happens to Roe v. Wade, the state legislature will have to weigh in on women's health care rights. They have already presented me with bills that restrict women's rights to choose, and I have vetoed them, and I will continue to do that.
Last year, Wolf vetoed a bill banning abortions after 20 weeks. Another bill banning abortions after 6 weeks has been introduced in Harrisburg. Stevens says Planned Parenthood is committing at least $1.5 million in an effort to help reelect Wolf. That money will go toward door-to-door canvassing, especially in the Philadelphia suburbs, and digital advertising.
Hi, I'm Scott Wagner. I based my campaign for governor on taking the trash out in Harrisburg. And believe me, we have a lot of trash in Harrisburg for me to clean up.
Republican candidate Scott Wagner voted for abortion restrictions in the state Senate and says he is proudly pro-life. But when asked after a recent town hall if he would sign an abortion ban if Roe versus Wade is overturned, Wagner didn't warm to the topic.
You know, that's a federal issue. I'm not running for president right now. I'm more focused on the problems in Pennsylvania.
He was reminded that the court could return the issue to the states and that the legislature might put an abortion ban on the next governor's desk.
It may, and whatever happens, happens.
You wouldn't commit to signing a bill banning abortion in the state?
Right now, in this interview, I'm not committing to anything.
Will that answer pass muster with committed opponents of abortion rights? Matthew Wagner of the Pennsylvania Pro-Life Federation, no relation to the Republican candidate, says he isn't troubled that Scott Wagner won't answer a hypothetical question from a reporter. He says the election presents a clear choice for those who believe abortion is wrong.
Governor Wolf has made it abundantly clear that he is indebted to and tied to radical pro-abortion insiders like Planned Parenthood, whereas Mr. Wagner is committed to protecting the most vulnerable among us.
There's a political logic to Wagner hedging. He probably already has the votes of most social conservatives. To win, he needs to reach out to moderates and independents. Terry Madonna, a pollster at Franklin and Marshall College, says for 20 years his surveys have shown more than 70% of Pennsylvanians believe abortion should be permitted at least in some circumstances. He says Wagner will feel pressure to clarify his position.
He's not going to be able to avoid it. It's going to make a big difference if Scott Wagner says that he supports a ban on abortion, no abortion at all. That view is held by about 1 in 5 Pennsylvanians.
For now, Wolf promises to veto an abortion ban, and Wagner prefers not to say. The issue is certain to come up in debates as the election approaches. For Here and Now, I'm Dave Davies in Philadelphia.
Our next guest is perhaps the world's most well-known Finnish comedian. His name is Ismo, and a video of his January appearance on Conan O'Brien's show has been seen over 60 million times on Facebook. Much of his comedy is about the English language and differences he's noticed between Finland and America.
I like driving here more than I did in Finland, because here the law is different, because here you can take a right on the red light. I love that. In Finland, that's illegal, so I feel like a criminal. I'm just always taking rights way more than I should. If the light is red, I'm gonna take a right. I basically go in circles. I love it so much.
Ismo will be appearing at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival in Scotland next month, and he joins us from London. Welcome to Here and Now.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Well, and great. I'm calling you Ismo, by the way. Like, you do have a last name, but you go by just Ismo, like Cher or Madonna or something like that.
Yeah, that's true. I don't think there's many Ismos in America or maybe in the world of comedy in general. So I thought that it's easier to just have my first name. And yeah, it's nice. 4 letters, like Cher.
Like Cher, right. And you're from Finland, which you talk about a lot in your comedy. I can't think of another comedian who's made it big who's from Finland. Can you?
Well, at least outside of Finland, I can't.
Well, why did you want to do that? Why did you want to take your comedy around the world?
Well, at first it was just, I really wanted to see, can I translate it and does it work in English? And it was just like I had nothing to lose. Like more than 10 years ago, I went to London actually to do my first English gigs, and I just wanted to try it out. And then it was so promising, and I kept going back, and then suddenly, now I'm doing way more English than Finnish, so it paid off.
But you do comedy also in Finnish?
Yeah. Yeah, when I go to Finland, I do it in Finnish, yeah.
Is it very different?
Well, yes and no. Like some jokes are, like, or some things I tell are completely, it doesn't matter which language, if it's a story or something like an observation. But then I do play a lot with the language, and that's mostly untranslatable. But actually, I think when I try to translate something untranslatable, I come up with new jokes. So it's good to think in two languages.
Well, let's listen to a little bit, for people who haven't heard you, of some of the comedy that you do that does involve the English language. Here you are talking about what's up.
But I have to say that it took a long time to learn the things, like the small, subtle things. Like, it took me a year to figure out that the correct answer to what's up is what's up.
How did you identify that as something that was weird? Because it's true, we say it all the time, nobody thinks about it.
Yeah, I think, like, I heard it a lot after moving to America, and it's weird because in Finland, if we ask a question, it's almost always like you have to answer something. Like when we just walk by somebody, we just say hi. But if we ask something, then we actually, like, are expecting an answer, but what's up is completely the opposite. What's up is just like, I remember the old commercials where people were just shouting that, what's up?
Right.
Nobody was answering.
I mean, you could say the same thing almost about how are you. You could say, how are you?
Yeah, I've been trying to get this right, because it's been so, that has been the most difficult part actually about moving to America, is the small talk rules. Because, like, my theory is that when somebody says, how are you have to say, good, how are you? Like, you have to kind of answer a little bit. Right. But with WhatsApp, it's just WhatsApp, WhatsApp. So that's my theory. But people do it differently. Everybody does it. Like, so it's those small talk things. And, like, how you doing? That's even, like, you never answer anything to that.
One of your most famous bits involves the word, and I'll just give people a warning if they've got kids in the car or something like that. They might be annoyed by me using this phrase, but ass. You talk a lot about ass.
Sometimes if you add ass to something, it can actually reverse the meaning of the original word. Like, for example, bad ass. That's good. Like, bad is bad, but bad ass is good. But not always. Like, dumb ass is still dumb.
And you go on about this. You've got a lot of observations on the word ass.
Oh yeah, it's like a 4 or 5 minute routine about just the word ass. And now sometimes people even stop me on the street and say that, hey, it's the ass guy. The whole thing started when I kind of tried to figure out what ass means, and I realized that then sometimes it doesn't mean anything. It's just like optional, like a long ass flight. It's the same flight without the ass. It's just a long flight. And my favorite, a grown ass man. It's a grown man, which was like, it, to me, it sounded like it's just the ass that has grown, but it's the whole man.
Do you use those phrases, by the way, that you've discovered and find so crazy that we use them? I mean, do you use them in when you're speaking English?
Well, yeah, I try to use them, but I'm kind of amused. Like, it's really hard for me to say that, oh, it was a long-ass flight. Like, without thinking that it's just weird to say. It's just, I'm too self-conscious of the word to kind of use it normally. But I try to use it. And the whole thing was like, I was just trying to figure out the English language and try to learn it. But then I stumbled into many jokes while trying to learn it. And I keep doing that all the time.
What you do kind of reminds me a bit of a routine that George Carlin did, the late George Carlin did a long time ago about sort of weird phrases in the English language. And I went back and I found one of the moments I'm talking about. I just want to play it for you. He is.
Down the tubes. You hear that one a lot. People say, the country is going down the tubes. What tubes? Have you seen any tubes? Where are these tubes? And where do they go? And how come there's more than one tube?
So there he is. And he talks about take the cake and some of these other ridiculous phrases that we use. But I mean, I wonder whether you got any inspiration from other comedians who have talked about these kinds of things.
Well, I've heard the comparison to George Carlin a few times, and it's been great because I really love his stuff. Yeah. I have listened to all his stuff years ago. And I definitely like the style of like analyzing the language and doing long lists. I remember when I read a book about how to do comedy, and the first rule was don't do lists. And then I said, screw that, I'm doing lists, and Carlin also does lists. So I love that. But yeah, definitely I've got inspiration. I think from him, like I listened to him years and years ago, but then lately sometimes I go back to it also. So. I do listen to a lot of comedy, and now it's all over Netflix and everything, so you can get comedy anywhere.
So where do you see your career going now?
Well, I really enjoy living in America, and the comedy scene is so great. Because like after doing Conan in the beginning of the year, I've been touring a lot inside the States and Canada and Australia and New Zealand. And yeah, I'm just happy to tour a lot. And of course, a special is, I think that's kind of the obvious next step I'm hoping to do is to do a comedy special. And yeah, I try to not make any rigid plans. I'm like, I never had plans when I started to do comedy. I didn't even know that you can make a living doing comedy when I started. It was just a fun thing to do. And then suddenly that was my job a few years later.
Do you worry at all about losing your sort of sense of being an outsider if you now live in Los Angeles as opposed to Finland?
Definitely not, because I think I've always felt kind of an outsider of the whole human race. So yeah, I'm just happy to learn better English, and my jokes will be more subtle, I guess, in the future if I do more language stuff. Mm-hmm. And of course I do lots of other stuff also. Yeah.
You ever do political comedy?
Not really. I don't follow it enough, and there's so many comedians doing that now.
Right.
So I do like exploring society and human behavior, but like a bigger scale than like day-to-day politics.
I was just asking you because, of course, the world's eyes were just on Finland, you know, in the last few weeks because of the Helsinki summit between Trump and Putin.
Oh, yeah. And actually, and that was a funny coincidence, I was there in Helsinki.
Uh-huh.
My main worry was that the world was watching Helsinki in a heat wave. So now people have like a hugely misunderstood the Finnish weather.
Okay. You know, there's one phrase that we don't say in the United States, but they do say where you are in the United Kingdom. They say they're going to hospital as opposed to going to the hospital. I've never understood that. My father's English. I don't understand why they take the out before they say hospital.
Yeah, that is weird. It's kind of like it would be like a continuous substance. Like I'm having milk. Like
right.
Not,
well, I guess you'd say I'm going to school in the U.S. You wouldn't say I'm going to the school, but you would never say I'm going to hospital. Here.
Hey, that's true, because like, going to school means like, that means that you're going there for years, but going
right.
to hospital, hopefully, it's just like
just
one
for an hour,
busy.
Right?
Yeah. This is a kind of a fun thing I just noticed, because I'm now in the UK, is that like it's a little bit of a difference between America and UK, is that like it's the highest honor in the UK to be called a sir. Like that's mm-hmm. that's the highest thing you can get is like being a sir. But in America, being called a sir means that you have kind of made a small mistake. Like, sir, you have to wait behind the yellow line, sir.
That's right. You're not really Sir Paul McCartney when that happens.
Yeah, it's like, sir, you have to pay for that. It's like you
excuse me,
wrong.
Sir.
Right? Yeah, it's kind of slightly a bad thing.
That is the Finnish comedian Ismo, who is performing at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival in August. Thank you so much, and good luck to you.
Hey, thanks so much. Thanks for having me.
Today, Zimbabwe held its first election without Robert Mugabe on the ballot. Mugabe was forced from office last November, but it won't be known until later in the week who will succeed him. Joining us now is NPR's Eder Peralta. He's just outside the capital, Harare. And Eder, we've seen pictures of long lines at the polls. What have you seen today?
Yeah, so I spent the morning in rural eastern Zimbabwe, and we have seen really long lines even out here. And one of the very interesting things is just that there's a lot of firsts in these elections. You have, you know, this is the first time that Mugabe is not on the ballot. This is the first time that the historical opposition leader, Morgan Tsvangirai, is not on the ballot. This is the first time that the opposition has been able to campaign freely. And what we heard a lot about here is that this was also the first time that people felt that they were free to vote their heart. I met a woman at one polling station who says she showed up at 5 a.m. and there were men there trying to intimidate. And she said that police actually pushed them away, told them to leave, and she was able to vote. And she says, you know, we're brave like this because we want change.
Now, no Mugabe, no Tsvangirai on the ballot, as you said. So remind us, who are the main presidential contenders?
So the main presidential contenders are Emmerson Mnangagwa, who is the guy who ousted Mugabe. So he used to be his former vice president and his former enforcer. And the other contender, there's actually 23 contenders, but these two guys are the ones who have a chance, is Nelson Chamisa. And Chamisa is a pastor. He's very young. He's 40 years old. What's interesting is these two candidates are actually running on very similar positions, and that is a change campaign. And Emmerson Mnangagwa is saying that he is not Mugabe. One of the interesting things is that we got a pretty big curveball yesterday when Robert Mugabe called journalists to his mansion, and he said that he would be supporting the opposition. Immediately, Emmerson Mnangagwa, the current president, the current incumbent president, said, you see, this means that Chamisa is now allied with Mugabe.
You know, it's hard, if not impossible, to overestimate the momentousness of this moment for Zimbabwe, right? Because Mugabe was in power there for almost 40 years. So, you know, all this talk about change from the candidates themselves, I'm just wondering, of the people, the regular Zimbabweans that you've had a chance to speak to, are they optimistic that real change can come? Because, you know, undoing the effects of 40 years of one man's rule is, that's going to take time.
You know, a lot of the people I've spoken to are very guarded. But then, after you talk a little bit with them, they reveal a deep, deep hope. And I think part of the reason for that is you have to understand the living conditions right now in Zimbabwe. The economy is incredibly depressed. The majority of young people don't have actual jobs. So there's a lot of hope that the next president can turn things around.
Well, that's NPR's East Africa correspondent Ader Peralta speaking to us from just outside of Harare. Ader, thank you so very much.
Thank you, Meghna.
Over the past several months, the Trump administration has decided to end the temporary protected status program for almost all of its recipients. TPS allows immigrants from places like El Salvador, Honduras, and Haiti to work and live in America after extreme weather or violence destabilizes their home countries. Earlier this year, NPR spoke with Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen about the decision.
To pretend that conditions continue to exist from a hurricane 20 years ago is fiction. Does that mean there isn't difficulty in that country? No. Does that mean we shouldn't take care of TPS? No. But does that mean that I have any authority to continue to grant them temporary status? It does not.
More than 300,000 people have to figure out what to do next as their TPS protections expire over the next few years. Jay Shah from member station WPLN reports on one Nashville restaurant owner who's decided to stay as long as she can.
Reina Arevalo started to cook when she was 8 years old. She loved it. She loved making Salvadorian food like pupusas, which are thick corn tortillas stuffed with beans, cheese, and meat. After 40 years of making them, it's become second nature. She rolls out the stuffed dough, slaps it with her palms, and throws it on the griddle. Arevalo was working at a restaurant when the news came in.
I was preparing the business for the day when I saw in the news they were saying they were ending TPS. I just stood there. I said, wow, what am I supposed to do now with everything I have? If I lose my social security, I lose everything.
Arevalo has been in Nashville for nearly two decades. She was a single mother in El Salvador and got temporary protected status in 2001 after a powerful earthquake caused widespread damage throughout much of the Central American country. She had four children back home and eventually brought two of them to the U.S. Now she has two grandchildren who are U.S. citizens. This kind of mixed status family is common. The Center for Migration Studies found that about 270,000 children were born in the U.S. to TPS recipients. For Arevalo, leaving the country would mean breaking up her family.
Because I have my grandchildren here and I love them a lot. I don't want to leave them alone.
The program was, by definition, intended to be temporary, but it continued to get renewed for decades, and immigrant families didn't put their lives on pause. Royce Murray is the policy director for American Immigration Council, a national advocacy group. She says TPS recipients are in limbo.
Salvadorans who, you know, have built their lives here and are now faced with an impossible decision about returning to a very violent country or trying to continue a life here that's no longer authorized.
Murray says some TPS recipients could apply for legal status, but there are no guarantees. The Salvadoran Migrant Institute told The Economist they expect no more than 15% of TPS recipients to actually return to El Salvador. And the Salvadoran government thinks that some people will move to Canada or other countries. But Arevalo isn't doing any of that. She's just going on with her life and hoping that the Trump administration will change its mind or Congress will pass legislation to protect her.
I ask God to give me strength to keep fighting and for him to allow me to get as far as that strength allows.
Arevalo applied to renew her TPS status, but after the Trump administration ended the program, she's not expecting it to arrive, leaving her undocumented, as she continues to work 13 hours a day, 7 days a week at her restaurant. For Here and Now, I'm Jay Shah in Nashville.
It's been nearly 3 months since the Kilauea volcano erupted in Hawaii, and lava flows are still disrupting everyday life. Lava has destroyed more than 700 homes, and recently a tourist boat got too close to the action and was hit by a lava bomb, injuring 23 people. Now there is pressure on the local government to establish a safe place where tourists can view the lava. Joining us now is Harry Kim, the mayor of Hawaii County. Mayor Kim, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you very much.
And first of all, we understand that one of the homes that was lost belonged to you.
Yeah, it was a family dream, personal dream. And yes, it was a vacation home, but not really. It was just a small little place, but it bordered the Waiopai ponds that anyone who snorkels in this island or state have heard about that. It's a beautiful, beautiful place of corals and of fish. That no longer exists, obviously.
So the incredible thing about this story is that it's ongoing. The lava is still erupting and nobody knows when it is going to stop. Do you have any sense of how long this could go on?
I don't know how, you know, because I was born and raised here in 1939, and that's how old I am. And so you see, you know, took part in various degrees eruptions in that area, the most active area in the world, I think, of Kilauea. And I've never seen anything like this, and there isn't a scientist in the world that have studied these volcanoes that have seen anything like this. It's an absolutely like you forgot to turn off your faucet, and it's a fear realization this might last years.
Which brings us to tourism, and that's obviously a major industry there. First of all, how has it been affected so far?
Yeah, it was just in the newspaper headlines where Jack's Tours, which have been around over 50 years, have just closed their doors. Mm. They're one of the major transport companies that depend on tourism for existence. And they stated that this was because of the loss of business because of the volcano. Outside of that, you know, it just depends on what kind of business you are. But if you're a small type of business, regardless of a restaurant, retail, or anything, you've lost 60, 70, 80% of your business and more.
Do you think that it's appropriate, though, for tourists still to be going out and trying to see the lava right now while it could injure them, hurt them, as it just did with this lava bomb injuring nearly two dozen people?
Is it appropriate for people to go and see or want to go see? Absolutely. All we're trying to do here is trying to identify an area that can accompany, you know, people and make sure that it is safe. We're dealing with a high level of sulfur dioxide.
Right.
We're dealing at a very high level of fumes called lays, which is a rare phenomenon in the world when lava enters and impacts salt water, and what is created is hydrochloric acid fumes. And that is very dangerous to mankind because it emits beautiful white steam that is laced with hydrochloric acid, fine particulates small enough for you to inhale and get embedded in your lungs.
So when you say all of that, though, it sounds like it's not very safe still to view this lava. Have you had any luck in finding a safe spot for people to go?
We had no luck, but we thought we did, and you know, but this thing changed so dramatically that right now we have people assigned, you know, to make sure they keep abreast of things and identify potential areas that we can open up. The problem here is you can always find a place that can accompany 10, 15, 20, 50, 100 people. But when you open up something like that, you're dealing with thousands of people.
So what about the people who've actually not just been injured but lost their homes? What kind of help are you giving them, or what do they need at this point?
Oh, boy, that's a very complex question. Obviously, the need is based on who you are. We had a lot of farms, different kind of farms, that were totally destroyed in various phases, including beautiful, beautiful orchards of the most beautiful orchids, et cetera, et cetera. A lot of them were totally destroyed by lava. Some of them were slowly destroyed because of the fumes of sulfur dioxide, combination of other gases, and others were totally isolated but not touched, but the fumes eventually engulfed it. Now you have your papaya farmers. Oh my goodness, you know, some of them are heartbreaking because papaya farmers, it's a horrid life. Most of these, if not all of them, are small farms. We were trying to help this one farmer out to find a way to get them in so they could harvest their papayas, and it was just not a successful do so. But right now, most of them, if not all of them, final decisions are not there yet because we're still in the emergency response. We're still dealing with a hazard. We don't know where the end is.
Right. Well, I hope the end comes soon and that this lava stops erupting. But, of course, as you've said, we have no idea how long it will continue. Harry Kim, mayor of Hawaii County in Hawaii, thanks so much.
Well, thank you for talking to me. Appreciate it.
Jury selection in the trial of President Trump's former campaign manager begins tomorrow in Virginia. Prosecutors have indicted Paul Manafort on multiple financial fraud charges. He's the first person caught up in the FBI's Russia investigation to go to trial, and the case could have big implications for the president. But questions of alleged collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia are not expected to come up in this case. We're joined now by NPR Justice correspondent Carrie Johnson. Hi there, Carrie.
Hi.
So, first of all, prosecutors have charged Manafort on 18 counts of fraud, lying, and tax evasion. And this isn't the only trial he's facing, right? So, remind us what he's alleged to have done.
Yeah, Magna, in this trial starting in Virginia, suburban Washington, D.C., tomorrow, he's accused of tax fraud, bank fraud, and some failures to disclose foreign bank accounts. In essence, the special counsel is arguing that Paul Manafort reaped something like $60 million through his work for lucrative lobbying work for the government in Ukraine. That former government was closely allied with Russia and Vladimir Putin. And the authorities in the U.S. say Manafort did not disclose that or pay income taxes on it. In fact, was trying to hide it and basically launder money through various operations.
Okay. Now, he has another trial expected to start in September in Washington. Why are there separate cases here?
Good question. So a lot of the offenses that for which he's going on trial in Virginia allegedly occurred in Virginia. Manafort has a residence there. And when prosecutors asked him whether he wanted them to wrap those new charges in Virginia along with an existing bigger money laundering case in Washington, D.C., Manafort said no. No dice. I want to be tried in both jurisdictions. So now we have this situation where he's going to trial in Virginia, a trial that could last about 3 weeks. And then in September, in the fall, he's facing separate, bigger money laundering charges in Washington, D.C. before a different jury there.
Okay. Now, what do we know about the lawyers who are prosecuting him in this specific Virginia case?
Sure. These are prosecutors from the special counsel Bob Mueller's team. Several of them have very long experience in financial fraud cases. Among them are Greg Andres, who was an official in the Obama Justice Department and also in the U.S. Attorney's Office in New York. Andrew Weissman, who famously led a prosecution of Enron, that failed Houston Energy Company more than a decade ago. And another senior prosecutor from Virginia who deals with public corruption, Uso Adonye. And we have finally a fourth Virginia prosecutor, Brandon Van Grack. All of these people have seen their way inside and outside of a courtroom for many, many years.
Okay. So this is really interesting, Carrie, because, Manafort's gone to trial, right? He hasn't pleaded guilty to this. So, I mean, what might prosecutors be hoping to do in this case beyond win? Of course, every prosecutor desires to win. But is there another strategy going on, perhaps ultimately flipping Manafort?
You know, this is remarkable. Remember that only something like 3% of all the federal cases in the U.S. system actually go to trial. It seems as if authorities in the special counsel's office and the FBI have been wanting Paul Manafort, President Trump's former campaign chairman and a guy with lots of ties to Russian oligarchs and officials in Russia, to give up something important. But Paul Manafort has resisted at every turn. He has denied wrongdoing, and he's, at least for right now, hell-bent on going to trial, not just in Virginia, but also in D.C. Remember, Paul Manafort is 69 years old. If he's convicted in either of these cases, he might wind up spending the rest of his life in prison. This is a guy who was a big-name lobbyist in Washington. He's now appeared in court in a jail jumpsuit.
Now, prosecutors are saying that they won't address questions of alleged collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia. Why is that?
Well, the judge in the Virginia case, Judge T.S. Ellis III, has said he doesn't want to make this some kind of theater or spectacular production. And most of the allegations for which Manafort is being tried involve his money, his personal finances, and his relationship with folks in Ukraine, not something having to do with the Trump campaign. There is one area in which Manafort's campaign work may come up in the course of the trial. Prosecutors allege that a banker gave Manafort a loan, even though he knew Manafort could not make good on that loan because this banker allegedly wanted a job in the Trump administration if Donald Trump won the White House.
I see. So then how could this trial affect Robert Mueller's broader investigation?
So this is the first trial to go to trial that Robert Mueller and his special counsel team have built and prosecuted. In and of itself, that will be meaningful because the president, as late as yesterday, was on Twitter calling this whole investigation a politically motivated witch hunt. If authorities are able to get a conviction in this case against Trump's former campaign chairman, it makes it that much harder for the president and his allies to argue that none of these prosecutions are valid.
Yeah. And as you point out, though, the president is distancing himself or is continuing to distance himself from Manafort, even though Manafort was his former campaign manager, as the president also continues to heavily criticize Robert Mueller's investigation. Just one last question, Carrie. Just got a couple seconds here. What sense do we have of how Manafort's defense team, what will they argue?
Well, Paul Manafort may be arguing that he was done wrong by his second in command, a guy named Rick Gates. Rick Gates earlier this year pleaded guilty. He's likely to be the star witness against Paul Manafort at this trial.
Well, that's NPR Justice Correspondent Carrie Johnson. Thank you so much, Carrie.
My pleasure.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.